county appraisal district, and others. The times which the court has allotted petitioners and respondents vary in each of these causes and will be announced prior to the oral argument. Counsel in the second and third sets of arguments do not have to remain in the courtroom while earlier matters are being argued, but we ask that you remain in the lawyer's lounge or nearby so that we may proceed to your cause without delay in the event a scheduled argument finishes early. Counsel in all causes are advised that these arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court, and should you desire to listen to the tapes of these arguments, you may make application with our clerk to do so. In the first cause, Stewart Title Guarantee Company versus Sterling Trustee, the court has allotted 25 minutes for the petitioner and the respondent to present an oral argument and 5 minutes for the petitioner to offer rebuttal. The court is now ready to hear oral argument from petitioner.
May it please the court, this is a case in which Mr. Dawson Sterling, that I'll refer to as Sterling, who was a sophisticated investor in real estate broker and a lawyer, and an ex-insurance company official, decided that he wanted to buy a tract of land of about 173 acres that had been foreclosed upon by the Equitable Assurance Company and its real estate investment trust. He got field notes for it, and he got a plat that had been used on a prior transaction that didn't close, went out and inspected it, and determined that these field notes included three tracts that had masonry homes built on them. So he came in, and he made a deal to buy it. He first determined that people that lived in those houses were the directors of a utility district that a great portion of property lay in, visited with them, found out that they had no opposition to him going on the board if he bought the property. He then made his contract. He was furnished with a title commitment by the title company that provided that the policy to issue would be subject to the rights of parties in possession unless he paid for an inspection to determine that no one was in possession. He did not do that. He also waived the survey clause so that it could be put into the policy when it was issued. At that time, under Rule P3 of the Insurance Commission rule, the rights of parties in possession exception was simply that if you did not have an inspection done, they could put in the exception for rights of parties in possession. That is in the policy that was issued. Now, he noted this difference in the description between the map he had and the field notes he had, so he asked the closer, is the policy that's going to issue going to cover everything in these field notes that's in the commitment? She told him that it would. He also asked if they would guarantee good and indefeasible title, and was told yes, that that's the type of policy that would issue. He then, at closing, signed a waiver of inspection, which is provided by the rules that the company has to have before they can put in this rights of parties in possession. Now, this waiver, he examined, asked if he had to sign it, and was told that if he didn't sign it, they couldn't issue the policy. He apparently made a decision right there that the waiver not only would cover him against anything that was of record, but that it would also control the terms of the policy that was issued. And later on in the trial, he was permitted to testify that that was his understanding, although there is no ambiguity in the terms of the policy that issued. It just simply says that it's subject to the rights of parties in possession. Now, after closing, he went out almost immediately and told the people who were living in those houses that he had bought their houses and that he wanted to make an arrangement with them for their continued occupancy. And they told him that they owned the houses. Well, the story on that was that when Equitable and its insurance trust had foreclosed on it, they had foreclosed and given the trustees deed for all of the property that was in the deed of trust. Several years before, there had been a partial release executed, but the partial release described these three tracts as lots and blocks in an unrecorded subdivision. It no plat had ever been recorded. Of course, that description was violative of statute that says you will not convey by unrecorded plats. Well, when the homeowners confronted him with the fact that they owned this, he then called upon the title company under the terms of the policy. And he was told that the policy contained an exception for rights of parties in possession, but on insistence that he was covered, that he had told that he had been covered by insurance, the title company, faced with the fact that, number one, he may own it because the release from that deed of trust had bad descriptions. Number two, that if he didn't own it, he may be precluded from recovering because of the rights of parties in possession exception. Number three, that Equitable had given a special warranty deed property, filed a declaratory judgment action to determine what the rights of the parties were, seeking first to show that he did in fact own the houses. Well, of course, in that action, the only party that had standing to clear that cloud was Mr. Sterling. But Mr. Sterling reacted by saying, no, the homeowners own that. I want the title company to pay me some money. And therefore, there was a judgment entered by agreement that they had a reformation of this release and their deeds so that they owned property, which completely cut him off. Now, the facts show that right of reformation was probably long since barred by limitation, but the only one who could assert that was the owner of the property or the claimant, who was Mr. Sterling. Now, after this agreed judgment was entered for the homeowners, there was a severance, and the parties were realigned. Mr. Sterling was named as plaintiff, and title company, a law firm, and the Equitable were named as defendants. We would call attention that one of the things that was stressed as being an unfair claim settlement practice was bringing that declaratory judgment action, which was authorized under the statutes. Now, they went to trial on this severed case, and just before concluding their case, it was announced that there was a settlement between the plaintiff and the other two defendants other than Stewart. The pleadings in that case at that time had an action where they sought to recover the same thing, $400,000, as the value of the property lost and consequential damages against all of the defendants in every count of it. One of the counts asked to recover it jointly and severally from them. But upon this settlement, Stewart amended its pleading to claim an offset for the amount that was paid in settlement, put in the evidence before the court that the settlement was in the amount of $400,000. And it is that amount that we claim that we are entitled to offset or a credit under the Bradshaw rule.
Before or after troubling?
That's the next question, Your Honor. Before or after troubling? We say that under the cases that this court has determined it would be before Treadwell. There are cases that have been decided by courts of civil appeals that were decided in cases where one party was DTPA and the other parties were sued under actions in which there could be no Treadwell. And they said in those cases that you Treadwell first and then take the deduction. We submit that everyone that was a defendant here was sued under an action that the damages could be trebled. They were all sued under DTPA, and the additional claim was made against the title company under Article 2121 of the Insurance Code for two different matters. One was unfair claim settlement practice, and the other for improper trade practice in the insurance business. Now, but we submit that it should be before Treadwell, because all of the people here were sued under the same type thing that they could be subjected to Treadwell damages.
How are offsets treated in other Treadwell damage contracts?
Well,
like the federal antitrust
law. In federal antitrust laws, I'm not sure. This court, though, has in an early case, has deducted the credit before Treadwell. And we submit that there's no difference between this case and that, really. That case, I will grant you, was a credit for an offset that was between the immediate plaintiff and defendant. But we submit that an offset for a settlement from another defendant should not be treated any differently from an offset because of a counterclaim that's asserted by the immediate defendant. Now, the Court of Appeals held that on the basis that the Duncan decision controlled and that Stewart had waived this right to any offset because it did not submit a comparative negligence issue. We think that that is error because the Duncan case clearly states that it applies only to those cases within the purview of what it called a tortfeasor, which was strict liability and warranty cases. Well, we submit that twice since Duncan, this court has stated that there should be a credit given for prior settlements. We cited those cases at the Mayo and the DeToka cases.
Counsel, what public policy would be served by allowing you this offset?
Well, Judge, it takes two to settle on anything. When a plaintiff can determine that he can get everything that he wants by settling with one or two defendants and leave one to go after, as in this case, then there is no deterrent to doing that on the plaintiff's part. It just costs him whatever his attorney's fees will be on the end of that.
That is often done in product cases, negligence cases. Why should we have a different rule for these types of transactions?
No, sir. But if a rule is now imposed on this type of transaction, it will be a change of what the rule has been in this type of transaction before. As I say, since the Duncan case, the DeToka and the Mayo case have both said that they would be entitled to a credit for what has been paid on actual damages before. Of course, in the DeToka case, I can't tell you why on the remand they didn't ask for that credit, but the Court of Appeals said, you know, they didn't ask for it, so we didn't give it to them in their opinion on motion for rehearing. Because this court's opinion had said they were entitled to it. Now, the public policy of doing this type offset as against doing an offset based on comparative causation? I really don't know which is best, but I see that both can result in evil, because there can be a situation where a party simply will not settle piecemeal where there's going to be a comparative causation applied because he can't determine whether he is going to get one of them out, and then everybody jump on that one as being solely at fault. I don't know which is best. But the next thing that happened was the testimony on the attorney's fees. Now, each of you has before you a group of exhibits. One of them is tab 4, testimony regarding attorney's fees. The Court of Appeals again said you cannot raise this question because you waived it, because you didn't object to the attorney's fees evidence when it came in. I think that is a misapplication of an earlier case that was decided by the first court that said that if your only objection is that there is no evidence, then the fact that there has been evidence put in the record without segregating constitutes some evidence. But at any rate, in this case, we had testimony that stated that their total attorney's fees were $345,000, including $10,000 in expenses. I then asked on cross-examination if they could segregate that. I asked if there were not actually more attorney's fees that were attributable to fights over discovery with other parties to which we weren't a party than there were in our case. And it was admitted that there were. And there is the testimony before you as to what was done when they were asked about segregation. I do not know how you could be expected to object at the time testimony first comes in as to attorney's fees when there are cases that hold that that is some evidence, and therefore the evidence would be admissible. The objection in this case was to the fact that there was a failure to segregate between the attorney's fees that were incurred in connection with the case against Stewart and those incurred in the case against others. We do not believe that the Court of Appeals should have held that that was a waiver when at the first instance that we could, we made that objection as to the failure to segregate.
Isn't it somewhat inconsistent to argue that the attorney's fees ought to be segregated when you say that the same claim that was settled was equitable with the same claim that was litigated with the title?
Just not in view of the evidence that by the great majority of it was in connection with fights that didn't concern us. In other words, fights on getting documents and things that were seemingly wholly unnecessary in
the
trial case.
Didn't Sterling need those documents to prosecute, or his claim was, need the documents to prosecute the case against whoever said that?
Well, he was needed those to try to prove some fraud on the part of Equitable and some fraud on the part of the law firm, but he had everything that he used against us in the documents that we produced. Now, everything that I have argued so far has dealt with there being liability. We submit that there was really no evidence of the unfair claim settlement practice, and no evidence of the unfair practice in insurance business. If you look at the testimony, the policy was not misrepresented. She stated that the description would be of the property that was in the commitment, and it was. There was never any statement that there would not be an exception in there for rights of parties in possession. And that, you know, was taken up at the closing and was discussed at the closing. There was no settlement offer or refusal to settle when liability became reasonably clear. There was a dispute as to liability, and a declaratory judgment action was filed to try to determine that dispute. No offer of substantially less than the amount recovered, or failure to provide an explanation of the basis of denial of liability. It was squarely stated it was on the basis that there was an exception for the rights of parties in possession. And on the improper trade practice insurance, you got the same type of things. There simply is not anything in there that they claim was stated that that was false. We submit that there was no material misstatement made and that there was no ground for liability shown. And when we get to the issue of damages, we objected to that issue number 9 for the reason that it simply presented a damage issue that had been condemned before in the Leyendecker case by this court. It was a claim for a partial loss on a piece of property and did not submit, as the Leyendecker case said you had to, what you paid for that piece of property and what the value was separately from the balance of the property. And we objected on that ground. But it was submitted in this fashion, which is exactly the way it was submitted in the Leyendecker case. Fair market value of the property to which title failed. And we submit that in this case, even the other issue that was submitted in Leyendecker, the value as represented versus the value as received, isn't applicable because under American Title Company versus Bird, this is a title insurance dispute. It's not a dispute concerning real estate or stock, and that measure does not apply. But this one has been specifically condemned in Leyendecker. Also, I'd like to point out that this asks if there were any deceptive trade practices, unconscionable source of action, unfair claim settlement practice, or improper trade practice found. In the judgment, they specifically stated that they were basing their judgment on the issues which related only to unfair claim settlement practice or improper trade practice defense. Under the finding on this issue, which is put in the alternative, the damages could all have been to deceptive trade practice. It could be that the arguments that they held us on insurance code and not on deceptive trade practice may not be true at all, because you could have had a finding there, an affirmative finding, and it all be attributable to deceptive trade practice. Now, we submit that because of the improper measure of damage that was submitted, that there was not a finding on which a judgment could have been rendered to you. There also was an error in the submission of some evidence. During the time this case was pending, Rule P3 was amended by the Insurance Commission, and it added to that exception that any rights parties in possession whose rights weren't shown of record. Well, after that, Stewart gave a seminar stating that it was their policy to follow that. That was offered in evidence, and was admitted in evidence, even though it was objected to as having come after a change in the rules, after a change in the policy form, and that was error. It was stated in there that that was devastating in the Court of Appeals opinion, but that in the same paragraph stated that it was harmless error.
Counsel, before you sit down, let me ask you, one of the amicus briefs urges that our decision in Vail against Texas Farm Bureau be overruled or be altered by this court. You don't seem too fond of that decision either. Is that your position, that we need to rewrite the Vail case?
I don't think that it's necessary to rewrite the Vail case to write what's wrong in this case, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, the real issue on this appeal is this court going to create a common law right of indemnity and contribution for company insurance companies that knowingly violate Article 2121 of the Insurance Code, despite the fact that the legislature has repeatedly evidenced a clear intention not to allow contribution and indemnity. I will explain it in 1 second. I want to say one thing about the facts, because I think there's a few facts that need to be clear on this record. The first thing is that the record will show that as soon as Mr. Sterling noticed a conflict between the survey he had and field notes, he notified Stuart Title and said, there's a conflict here, and I want to know what I'm going to be getting these three water district lots. And he needed the water district lots, as I've explained in my brief, to control the development and utilities in the entire subdivision. So it's not a case of Mr. Sterling hiding the ball. He brought it to Stewart's attention. Stewart says they reexamined the title and they simply, quote, overlooked, unquote, 11 recorded instruments, any one of which their own employee admitted would have told them that these three lot owners own their lots. They also, quote, overlooked 3 general warranty deeds into these three lot owners from the 1970s that were in their own file. Now, the second thing is that neither of the commitments that Stewart issued to Mr. Sterling prior to closing had any specific exceptions for rights of parties in possession, as Mr. Pittman represented. Stewart, at trial, attempted to offer into evidence what the jury found to be a fake, ungenuine document that had a specific rights of parties in possession exclusion typed in, and that's Exhibit 5, and this is covered in a footnote on about page 4 of my brief. And the jury chose to disbelieve that that was a genuine document. Now, the third thing that I want to correct is the article... Yes, Your Honor.
In regards to failure to find the documents prior to closing, what duty did the title company have to search out those documents? Doesn't it just ensure the title, and if it wants to go about it haphazardly,
Judge, I understand. I'm not asking you to overrule Stewart versus Cheatham. I believe in that case. But this was a specific request. This is not just issuing the policy. Here you have an oral request. Make sure that we've got title. And he went to the closing, and he said, I want to make sure that I'm going to get title to these lots. And Ms. Cameron orally stated, yes, that knocked Stuart Cheatham out. Stuart Cheatham doesn't apply. This is not simply a case. This is involved oral misrepresentations. The second thing is that he said, I want to make sure you're going to give me fully insured title to the three lots. And Ms. Cameron said, I am. Now, I've covered this all in my brief about the waiver form that he signed, but the waiver form that he signed contained a different provision of rights of parties in possession than the one that was actually issued in the policy. The third thing I wanted to point out is that the Article 2121 count on which we sued Stewart did not involve joint and several liability. I think Mr. Pittman misspoke. At the transcript at page 165, count 9, that counts only against Stewart. Now, the facts of this case are really outrageous. Stewart's employee, the jury found, and these facts have been proven and accepted, and that Stewart knowingly misrepresented the coverage that was going to be provided by the policy. That Stewart, and Stewart admitted it issued an illegal policy and then relied on the illegal provision in the policy in denying coverage. Stewart's claims counsel, Madison Wright, admitted to the jury that he denied this claim in a letter after he had already discovered the three general warranty deeds to the three lot owners in Stewart's file. The jury specifically found a whole basket full of insurance code violations and wrongful claim settlement practices. Now, instead of paying this claim, which is now, today, over 7 years old since we got a judgment, I mean, since we filed a claim, pardon me, we're still up here fighting this. Stewart refused to pay a legitimate claim. They arbitrarily denied coverage.
Counsel, excuse me.
Yes, Your
Honor. You're saying you have not covered. You got $400,000 and the jury found the damages were $200,000. Is that not true?
Yes, we did get $400,000 and the jury found actual damages of $200,000 plus the attorney's fees.
The issue here, whether or not the one contribution rule was to be applied?
Yes, Your Honor, I'll get to that right now because there's seven reasons it shouldn't be, public policy reasons. The first one is the legislature has never authorized contribution or indemnity under Article 2121. Now, neither the DTPA nor 2121, when originally acted in 1973, provided for contribution or indemnity. In 1977, in response to the Volkswagen versus Lick case out of El Paso, 544 Southwest 2nd 442, which held that there is no right to contribution under the DTPA because the legislature has not enacted any such right in the statute. The legislature in 1977 elected to amend the DTPA to add a statutory right of contribution and indemnity under Article 17.55A. They chose not to amend Article 2121, Section 16, which is the 77 legislature, that was the treble damage provision under Article 2121. Now, this is highly significant because certainly Justices Doggett and Mosley will remember this. The DTPA and Article 2121, subsection 16, the private cause of action for unfair claims practices, was passed in the same bill on the same day by the 73 legislature. They were the same act, the same Senate bill. In 77, they amended one of them to allow for contribution, and they left the other one without contribution. I say that's very strong legislative intent that the legislature did not and does not intend to allow contribution for companies that engage in unfair claim settlement practices. And I would quote Justice Gonzalez in Morris v. Chan, who said that this court is to look at the absence of provisions in an act to determine legislative intent. In fact, he said every word excluded from a statute must be presumed to have been excluded for a reason. And there is no right of contribution or indemnity in Article 2121, period. There's no statutory right. Now, here, this is legislative intent. That's the first reason. The legislature has looked at this. They decided to amend the DTPA in 77, added contribution. They did not add it under the 2121. Now, the second reason is the jury found a knowing violation of Article 2121. This wasn't an accident. This was an intentional violation of Article 2121. The legislature has
really simple recovery rule doesn't depend on whether or not that violation is
known. Pardon?
I mean, if the culprit is knowing about it, then the plaintiff can recover multiple times, but if it's accidentally can't.
No, sir, I do not. In fact, this statute was mandatory at the time as treble damages.
So but regardless of what it is knowing, you claim that there's no contribution.
Yes, sir. I'm just giving you another reason in this case not to allow it. The second reason is this was a knowing, intentional violation, what the jury found. And as this court knows, the legislature is addressed in Article 33.022 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, which is the contribution statute. the question of indemnity, and it says you don't get indemnity for intentional torts. And I contend that a knowing violation of the insurance code is an intentional tort.
How did you come to the conclusion that it is a tort? It is a hybrid, I agree, but what do you base the statement on that the DTPA is a tort action?
The Article 2121 is a tort action. It is a statutory cause of action, Your Honor. It is a statutory cause of action. I agree with that. But I think the legislature still intends not to allow insurance companies to violate who engage in unfair claim settlement practices and misrepresent their policy to obtain contribution or indemnity from other folks. That's really my argument. The third argument is Stewart's request for an offset of credit clearly violates public policy in this case, and I refer to Article 41454 of the State Board of Insurance. It's Sterling Brief at page 6. That board order holds that it is an unfair claim settlement practice for an insurance company to refuse to pay under its policy on the basis that others may be responsible in law for the damages suffered. That is exactly what they have done in this case. Exactly what they've done. Instead of paying under their policy like they should have and pursuing subrogation rights against these people they say are culpable third parties, they deny coverage and they're in this court saying that we don't owe any money because this is really all the fault of Equitable and Butler and Binion, and Equitable and Butler and Binion have already paid Mr. Sterling for all his damages. Well, all I'm telling you is the board order says that's an unfair claim settlement practice. So to allow them an offset, in my opinion, in this case, would be violating that board order. The fourth reason is both the court and this legislature have held that the proper way to handle a claim for an insurance company is to pay the claim and to then exercise their common law right of subrogation. That's what an insurance company is supposed to do. They pay the claim, and as a matter of law, they are entitled to then be subrogated and go after the people they allege are culpable third parties. In this case, I guess, Butler and Binion and Equitable. And instead, what they're doing here is they're denying the claim, and they're asking you to enforce a right of subrogation as automatically as a matter of law against two other parties. That's really what they're doing here. Now, I think the public policy ought to be, if you want to collect against people you claim are culpable third parties, or if you want to get contribution and indemnity, then you pay the claim to your insurer, and you go out and pursue these people. You have an automatic right as a matter of law to do it. The insurer can't even stop you. The fifth reason is, I think the Stewart's request for credit turns the collateral source rule on its head. It's pretty much conceded that if Stewart had paid this claim to Mr. Sterling, as it should have under his policy, neither Butler and Binion nor Equitable could have possibly obtained any credit for that payment because it's from a collateral source. It's from Mr. Sterling's own insurance company. He bought the policy. It's a collateral source. And this court expressly recognized in Brown versus American Transfer and Storage that payments from a collateral source are not to be counted under the one recovery rule of Palestine Contractors. Here, Stewart is asking the Texas Supreme Court to apply the one recovery rule in effect to a collateral source, the payment that it should have made to its own insured, even though it didn't make the payment. So I think that what it's asking you to do is to create a special super right of offset that that ordinary defendants don't have.
Is there any authority for referring to joint tort feasors as collateral source?
Pardon me? Is there any authority for
referring to joint tort feasors as a collateral source? The context I'm familiar with collateral source is when you receive some other kind of benefits, insurance proceeds from some other arrangement that you make. It doesn't have anything to do with the
plan that you make. Well, these aren't joint tort feasors. I'll get to that. These really aren't joint tort feasors under what we're suing for because there's really two causes of action. There's a misrepresentation as the title that was engaged in possibly joint tort feasors. You could even include Stewart in that. But there's another separate, entirely separate cause of action out of here under Mayo, and that is insurance company's bad faith and failing to pay his claim. And that's where I think that it applies. The sixth reason, and probably the strongest reason, that the one recovery rule doesn't apply in this case, is so simple I can't believe it didn't come to me the last week. The statute says it doesn't apply. The statute that this case was decided under mandates recovery of triple damages for violations of the insurance code. So it itself mandates not single recovery, but triple recovery under the statute. And that's what we have here when we have a knowing violation. And we have a knowing violation that's established by the facts. There's no way anybody could look at this record and say that we didn't have it. We had it. And the statute itself says you get a triple recovery. And this treble recovery provision in Article 2121 was enacted 38 years after Baylor versus Bradshaw. And it doesn't mandate, doesn't say just single damages, it says triple damages. Seventh reason. Judge, the way I look at it, we've only recovered $65,000 more than the attorney's fees spent through trial so far.
But if you're successful in your argument here, you're going to get five times your actual damages by the claim. Is that right?
For different torts. Yes, Your Honor.
That's the net result. For the same injury.
No, sir, not for the same injury. I don't buy that. That is not right because there are two different torts and two different injuries. One tort or one statutory cause of action, whatever it is misrepresenting title. He was supposed to get title. He didn't get title. And that we can put all three of these parties in one basket for. There is a separate tort, and that is failing to pay your insurance policy and engaging in unfair settlement practices. And for that separate act, under which only Stewart was sued, the jury found $200,000 damages. Now, I'll admit that in the damage issue, the court lumped all the stuff together, and Mr. Pittman's right on that.
That's the total.
I don't think it's total damages. I think that the court lumped them all together, and he's out anyway on that because he failed to object and ask for separate instructions on separate measures of damages, Your Honor.
But doesn't that include all of your claims?
No,
$1,000 is all of the damages that Sterling suffered.
Well, it's all the damages that they suffered against Stewart because that's the only party that was left in the case they were deciding from. Remember, see, and that's when the TLTA brief is wrong. We settled in the middle of trial, not before trial, and Equitable and Butler and Binion were dismissed. So when the jury went in the jury room, they knew they were deciding damages just against Stewart Title Guarantee Company. They weren't even considering damages against Equitable, and they weren't asked to decide any issues about what Equitable and Butler and Binion had caused for damages. They were just asked about Stewart.
If they had been, what would be the different measure?
It might be the same measure. As a matter of fact, the Supreme Court, this court in Vail says that as a matter of law, measure of damages is the amount of money you should have been paid under your policy, and you're right.
That's $200,000.
That's $200,000. Well, that's what the jury found in this case. Yes, Your Honor. My seventh reason is that I believe that if there is any if there was any common law right of contribution under Duncan, then they waived it. They didn't submit a comparative negligence issue, comparative causation issue. I have covered this fully in my brief, and I really can't add anything to that argument other than what's in the brief. But if he's right, and if there is a common law right of contribution, then they had a duty to submit a comparative causation issue to the jury, and they didn't do it. The Mayo and the DeToka cases that were talked about in the motion for rehearing really do not mandate any kind of different result in this case. In the first place, Mayo specifically authorizes separate recoveries for separate wrongful acts. And here we have separate wrongful acts. This would be a different case, and I would lose if Mr. Sterling had never bought title insurance. Then it would be one big joint tort. But you've got a triangle. You've got misrepresentations about the title, and you've got a separate cause of action over here for misrepresenting his title insurance policy and not paying under your policy. And Mr. Sterling's here in the middle. So he's got two different causes of action. Now, Mayo says you can't recover twice from the same party for the same act. And I don't disagree with that. I agree with that. But that's not what's really involved here. We've got separate causes of action. Now, DeToka, on the offset question, I think it's barred. I think the person thinks it's barred by a cloud of stars rule. This court did say in DeToka that the defendant had a right to ask the trial court for an offset down below. Well, if you go back and look at the opinion that was published afterwards, there isn't any offset even mentioned. And I think that it was barred by a collateral source rule. I think that the title insurance company pays its insurer. Mr. Sterling paid his premium. I mean, Equitable and Butler and Binion didn't. That's what it takes to make title insurance companies pay their claims in this state. Then I think it ought to be more.
And that's what it comes down to.
That really is what it comes down to, Judge. I agree. This case is being watched a little bit because of all the amicus, all the local counsel for Stewart everywhere file amicus briefs, and Mr. Morris being on the TLPA board, and they file a brief and all that. I know because I'm on it too. But I tell you, this case, we need to send a message to these people. If you deny a claim arbitrarily or for some ridiculous pretext reason, and then you fail to pay your claim, and you engage in unfair claim settlement practices, and you drag your guy through the appellate court to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars fighting him and make this a holy war, then you're going to pay damages. And I'll tell you what, not every title insurance in some company in this state is opposed to this case at all. They think that people ought to be paying their legitimate claims. And
are we a little outside of the record here?
Pardon me, John. Yes, sir. I'm sorry.
Okay. Can you cite the page in the record for that?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to address the attorney fees in 1 second because there's four arguments, Your Honor. That the first one is, I believe the Court of Appeals was exactly right. Stewart's objection was to the charge. Stewart's objection to the charge was really an objection to the introduction of evidence in the case and not to the propriety of submitting the proposed charge. The Osaba case and the House v. Barton case both say that Stewart's failure to object to the segregation of attorney's fees at the first available opportunity waives the objection, and I agree with that. And, you know, these aren't cases in some weird jurisdiction that the trial counsel didn't know anything about. They're in our Court of Appeals where both trial counsel live and practice law every day. In any event, even if those rules didn't apply, Stewart denied coverage, forced its insurer to file a suit to defend his title against the three lot owners and to protect his rights. And this court held in Shaver versus National Title and Abstract Company and a whole bunch of other cases that if an insurance company wrongfully denies coverage and forces its client to get in a lawsuit, then it's going to have to pay all his reasonable attorney fees. Now, I can't say any better than this. Stewart started this war, not Sterling. If Stewart Title Company had said, "I'm sorry, you've lost your title. We're going to pay your claim. How much is it?" And we'd argued about whether it was $300,000 or $200,000, and we would have settled. That would have been it. There wouldn't have been any of these other claims. They decided to deny the claim. They made him file suit. They made him go through all this litigation. And now they're in here asking you to reverse and remand on attorney's fees. The fourth reason, and this was pointed out by one of the justices is that prosecuting all of these causes of action was so intertwined that there really wasn't any way to segregate out attorney's fees. You know, how much attorney's fees did you incur in fighting the claims of the Ashes and the Vicks and the Ernests, who were the three lot owners? How much attorney's fees did you incur fighting Stewart? You know, how much attorney's fees did you incur going to this deposition and that deposition? Well, you know, it's impossible. It was all one big, giant mess in which Mr. Sterling was thrown into a suit. He had to try to protect his title or get some damages from his title insurance company. And
Your time's running out. Let me just ask you a question with regards to DeToka. Do we have to overrule DeToka in order to affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals?
Oh, no. I don't think DeToka applies. I think DeToka was decided correctly. No, not at all. I don't think so. I mean, what we're talking about here is a common law right of contribution First of all, the statement in DeToco was dicta anyway. You just said, the court just said, you have a right to go down. We're doing it, reversing this without prejudice to your right to go down and remanding without your right, prejudice to your right to go down and ask for these fees. It never came back up here. I mean, I asked for the offset. It never came back up here. So DeToco does not have to be overruled at all. I don't even think it has to be distinguished. The conclusion, I pray that this court affirm this judgment as soon as possible. Thank you, Your Honor. Unless there are any questions.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May I please support? What this case keeps coming back to is that Mr. Sterling, as found by the jury, had total damage for everything everybody did to him that he complained about in this lawsuit, for what Equitable did to him, what Butler and Binion did to him. The jury found he had total damages of $200,000.
What about the argument that the jury knew that two of the parties that were there when the start of the trial are no longer there? They've settled that claim. And therefore, they're only focusing on the damages that your client caused.
But look at the damage issue as submitted to that jury. You are instructed in arriving to your answer to special issue number 9, you should consider as the measure of damages the following: the fair market value of the property and any consequential damages. Those are the damages that he sought from everybody. The loss of the property. You go down his fifth amended petition, that's his trial pleading that he went to trial on. He has like A through P of allegations, prayers for relief against everybody. Every one of them. He sits. The value of the loss of the property, which he alleged to be $400,000, plus his contract. Now, Mr. Hutchison kept talking about if Stewart had just paid this claim, we wouldn't be here. There's a problem on that, and that is, number one, there was a genuine issue of coverage, and number two, there was certainly a hot dispute as to the amount of Mr. Sterling's damages.
How can there be a genuine issue of coverage when you find your own file from deeds that you overlook?
Your Honor, I will say this. The policy itself specifically excluded from its coverage, unambiguously, the rights of any parties in possession of the property out there.
But isn't it true, counsel, that he was relying upon the oral statements made by the closer? Didn't he ask at closing certain questions with respect to whether or not everything in the field notes were covered?
Yes, sir. He asked whether all of that property was covered subject to the terms of the policy. And it was covered. There was no misrepresentation. All of that property was there. It was just subject to the rights of any parties in possession. Now, one thing I think that the court needs to be real clear on is nobody knew that there was anybody out there except Mr. Sterling. He had been out there. He had been in those houses. He had been to a water district meeting out there in those houses. He was very careful at the closing to keep referring to those things as water district lots. Now, I don't know about you, but when somebody says lots, that means a different thing to me than when somebody says houses. He was the only one who knew that there were houses out there with people living in them, and he purposely phrased his questions and everything that way for a reason.
Now, it boggles my mind, counsel, that your title would issue a title policy while even respecting the premises. Well, it's like it was a tactical decision just to hide so you could have an exclusion.
No, Your Honor. There, under Rule P3, all of the standard practice in the state of Texas is that all title policies are issued subject to the rights of parties in possession so long as you obtain the waiver of inspection that was obtained by Stewart in this case. Mr. Sterling signed that waiver of inspection, authorized that policy to be issued subject to rights of parties in possession.
What's the cost differential between a policy and a waiver?
It depends, but generally it's somewhere $50 to $100. You have to pay. What happens is the title company actually sends someone out there to inspect the property. And, of course, if that had happened here, they come back and say, wait a minute, there are three houses out there with people living in. But that's the purpose of the rule at that time called for. If the waiver of inspection was signed, the policy could be subject to the rights of parties in possession. That's what was done. There's nothing out of the ordinary that happened in this particular transaction, other than the fact that Mr. Sterling knew and Stewart didn't.
I suppose that the jury was not told the amount of the settlement.
No, Your Honor, they were not told the amount of the settlement.
Regarding the offset, hasn't the legislature already spoken by authorizing statutory indemnity for DTPA claims and omitting it for insurance code claims?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. I think that the way this court has always looked at the matter is in terms of defining the term actual damages. That's what this court did in Smith versus Baldwin, where they allowed the offset, and in the cases that followed Smith versus Baldwin, in effect, what the court has said is that actual damages under the DTPA, which is the same term used under 2121 of the insurance code, that actual damages are the net damages that are occasioned to the plaintiff, and that offsets should be taken into account before you treble the actual damages. And we submit that also the offsets due to settlements with other parties ought to be taken into account before you treble the actual damages.
Then is there no difference between an insurance code claim and a DTPA claim?
Well, that
language is meaningless?
As your Honor knows, the two are consistently intertwined. The DTPA specifically says in 1750 that a violation of 2121 of the insurance code is a violation of the DTPA. The two of them are so intertwined that I really don't think that there is any difference. And again, the court has always approached it from the terms of an actual damage perspective as opposed to contribution, indemnity, that sort of thing.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes argument in the first cause. The court will take a brief recess.